Began our study of Masechet Beitza last week, but we really spent most of the time discussing the different kinds of muktzah. So most of you are here. Those who weren't here, we'll get to the different kinds of muktzah throughout the Gemara, but it's good to sort of, it would have been good to know them in advance. We're going to begin again with the first line of the Mishnah. We really finished the Mishnah last week, but we're going to review the first line again, because that first line is going to be the central topic of discussion at the beginning of the Gemara. And it's also an interesting Tosfos over here, which is very relevant for Halacha. Beitza shenolda beYom Tov, an egg which is hatched on Yom Tov. Beit Shammai omrim te'achel, Beit Shammai says you're allowed to eat it. Uveis Hillel omrim lo te'achel. And Beis Hillel says, you're not allowed to eat it. We discussed last week that this Mishnah contains some of the chumras of Beis Hillel and kulas of Beit Shammai. There are a few areas where Beis Hillel was machmir and Beis Shammai is mekel, yet we still follow Beis Hillel. You take their chumras along with their kulas. Okay. The Tosfos ask an interesting question. It's the first question in Tosfos on the left-hand side. Beitza shenolda beYom Tov. Ve'im tomar, you see where the Tosfos begins? Ve'im tomar, if you shall ask.
Okay, wait, Tosfos.
Right there, on the left. The top line on the left.
Oh, of course.
Okay. Ve'im tomar, amai lo tana osrin umatirin. Why doesn't the Mishnah say, Beit Shammai osrin, Uveit Hillel matirin, Beit Hillel permit. Right, it's a funny kind of thing. It says Beit Sashen Olda Beyom Tov, Beit Shammai say you're allowed to eat it, and Beit Hillel say you're allowed to eat it. Why don't they just say Beit Shammai prohibit it? Beit Shammai permit it, and Beit Hillel prohibit it. Why don't you use that other language? What do you think? Do you think that's a good question? Why?
Why is it a good question?
Why the language so awkward?
Okay, so one thing, in a technical way, if they would have said, Beit Shammai osrin uveit hillel matirin, it would have been a shorter Mishnah. So that's one reason, right?
Beit Shammai matirin,
though. I have my own prejudices. I'm so used to the other way around, right? Beit Shammai matirin and Beit Hillel osrin. So why, if they said it that way, they would have skipped omrim in both cases.
Sure.
So that's one reason why it's a question. And what else? What's the difference between osrin and matirin and tachal and tachal?
You don't know what you're prohibited.
Maybe.
The discussion is just during yantif what you can eat the egg, right?
Okay.
You're not sure then what are you prohibited or entitled to do.
What else might you do with an egg besides eat it?
It's more general.
Okay. Okay, good. That's good. Both of those are good.
Wouldn't have anything to do with the fact that they're making the point that this time it's the opposite of the normal Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai behavior?
No.
Okay. Is it the first
suggestion in Tosfot is Wendy's suggestion, and the second suggestion is Erica's suggestion. Okay?
Hang out with us.
So there you go. That's pretty good, right? First they reject Wendy's suggestion, then they reject Erica's suggestion. So they don't like either answer. But both answers were possible answers. Okay. Vechitema, if you shall say, Osrin mashma she'asur le'olam. That's exactly what Wendy said. Maybe you'll say that if they said Osrin instead of lo te'achel, you would have thought that it's always usher, that if an egg is laid on Yontif, then it remains prohibited after Yontif as well. You might have thought that. And so maybe that's why it says te'achel and lo te'achel, and it doesn't say osrin umatirin. Ze eino, we're on the third line in Tosfot. The third line on the top of the left-hand side is Tosfot. The top of the left is Tosfot. And the third line, the first word on the line is le'olam. Ze eino. That can't be. It's not because you might have thought that it's always prohibited. Why? De amrinan lekaman. Because we say later in the Gemara on Daf Vav Amud Aleph, Efroach shenolad beyom tov, asur. Meaning a chick, Efroach is a chick, that's also born on Yom Tov, that hatches on Yom Tov, is also prohibited. And asur, hainu beyomo, that only is on Yom Tov or on Shabbat. That is not talking about afterwards. And everybody agrees that there asur means hainu, means beyomo, only on that day. So the word asur does not mean asur le'olam. It doesn't mean asur forever. It just means asur on that day. So that could have been a word to use. The ode, furthermore, this is not the answer. Another reason why it's not the answer. De amrinan mutar shemen shebaner Rabbi Yehuda oser. The oil of the candle is permitted and Rabbi Yehuda prohibits it. Meaning, this is on Yom Tov, when lighting a fire is permitted. So what about the oil? Is the oil considered muktzah or not? The oil that's now under the flame, is that muktzah or is that not muktzah? So one opinion is that it is not muktzah, mutar shemen shebaner, Rabbi Yehuda oser, v'hainu dafka be'oto yom, and that's also just on the same day, on Yom Tov, or on Shabbat. So that's not the answer. It's not because you would have thought that it's always prohibited if they say usher. Rather, yesh lomar dehi havatane usrin umatirin. If they would have said prohibited and permitted, haisi omer shemashematirin habeitza hainu lataltel. Of al da'achila asura.
Oh, that was when.
And that was Erica's suggestion. If they would have only said asur and mutter, I would have thought that it's permitted to carry an egg, to handle an egg, that it's not muktza with regards to handling. Like, for example, my cell phone is muktza with regards to handling. I can't pick it up or whatever. But eating it is still prohibited. It's muktza with regards to eating it, but not with regards to handling it.
Can I ask just a question, because I might have missed this, but how do we even know at this point we're discussing muktza?
Oh, sorry, I made that assumption. But last week we were discussing the different kinds of muktza. One of the kinds of muktza that the central discussion of this Gemara is nolad. Nolad is something which did not exist before Shabbos, and it only comes into existence on Shabbos or on Yom Tov. Nolad means born. It's born on Shabbos. So the examples that we gave are, for example, snow. If it snows on Shabbos, then that snow is muktzah, because it didn't exist before Shabbos, and now it exists on Shabbos. So for example, you know, if you want to go play in the snow, you can go play in the snow. If it snowed on Friday, and now it's Shabbos morning, and the snow, I wouldn't play in the snow on the streets, you know, the next day, but if you go to Central Park, you probably still can play in the snow. And but if it snowed on Shabbos, you can't play in the snow, because that snow is muktzah, because it's nolad. And we discussed the possibility also that newspapers might be nolad. The Saturday morning newspaper. Maybe that's nolad, because that newspaper certainly didn't exist before Shabbos. And here it is. It was printed on Friday night. So maybe it is. Maybe it's also muktzah. That's a discussion.
Nolad is a category
of muktzah. Nolad is a category of muktzah. That's right. And nolad actually makes a lot of sense. Nolad makes a lot of sense in terms of how we view Shabbos, because whenever we discuss the 39 melachot, we call them creative melachot. We want to leave the world as it is, and we want to experience the world as it is on Shabbat. We rest on Shabbat, and so nolad actually makes a lot of sense as a category of prohibition.
It makes sense, but it
makes sense
in a theoretical sense. Yes. Yeah, I'm not saying you shouldn't read the, we'll discuss the newspaper. Right. You'll see. If we get to this Tosfot today, you'll see why you're allowed to read the newspaper on Shabbos.
On a short Shabbos, it makes sense.
On a long one.
That's right. So when we get to, there's a Tosfot on this page, which will explain to you why reading the newspaper is probably permitted. Okay. Ve'yesh lomar, so we said that. Ye'esh lomar de'iha v'tane yosrenu matirina iti omer shemashe matirina beitza hainu l'taltel avel b'achila asura. Perhaps there's a difference, a distinction between eating and carrying. Carrying, they permitted, Beit Shammai permitted, but eating, even Beit Shammai may be prohibited. If it would have said prohibited and permitted. Okay? Because eating might be a more stringent thing in general.
What's going to carry an egg? I mean, what's the...
Well, you might just want to put it
aside. Yeah, they laid the egg and you want to make room for more eggs to be laid. I don't know.
Sorting.
Yeah. V'hachi amrinan. And so how do we know? So by the way, Tosfot didn't make this up. Tosfot knows that there's a distinction between carrying and eating from other Gemaras. So they're going to cite the other, because you know that's how Tosfot works. Tosfot is not like, you know, in Brisker Lundus, when you want to make a distinction, you don't have to have a source for the distinction. You just have to be creative and think of a distinction, and that's the distinction you come up with. But before that, you know, the Tosfot didn't make up distinctions. They have distinctions that they find in the Gemara. V'hachi amrinan gabei nochri echad, a non-Jew, shehevi dagim lefnei Rabban Gamliel, who brought fish before Rabban Gamliel.
Presumably on...
On Yom Tov.
On Yom Tov.
The Amar Mutarim Heim. And he said, these fish are permitted.
Who said so?
Rabban Gamliel.
Mm-hmm. Not the non-Jew.
Not the non-Jew. That's right.
Who cares?
She'ain Ella, she'ain Retzoni... Lekabel heimenu. However, I don't want to accept these fish from him. They're permitted, but I don't want to accept them from him. Umeisik mehai, and the Gemara understands from there, from that story, my mutarim letaltel, aval be'achila asurim. What are they permitted? What's permitted about them? To carry them. But eating them is still prohibited. So there's a story, just to sum up, there's a story in the Gemara about a fishmonger who brought fish to Rabban Gamliel on Yom Tov. And Rabban Gamliel said, these fish are permitted, but I don't want to accept them. The Gemara which ensues after that story, on Daf Chaf Dalet Amud Aleph, explains that that they are permitted to carry, but prohibited to eat.
And how did they know that?
And that's...
Why is it not permitted for kosher reason, and he just didn't want to take it from this guy because he didn't like the guy, or I don't know, some other reason.
What do you mean?
In other words, why is it tiltal that he was commenting on?
That's right. So
it could be kosher. These are okay. I accept these fish as being kosher, but I don't want to take them from him.
And aren't you always allowed to carry on Yom Tov?
Yeah, and he's a Nachri, so what's...
That's true. So maybe it's on Shabbat.
Well, he could accept them.
How could he accept
them? No, carrying on Yom Tov, carrying on Yom Tov is meaning outside of an Erev. Yes. But Muktzah is still prohibited on Yom Tov. You're not allowed to carry Muktzah even on Yom Tov. Carrying Muktzah, I'm sorry, I meant carrying.
He caught them on Shabbat? Or Yom
Tov? He must have been, no, he caught them on Yom Tov.
Caught them on Yom
Tov, sure. He caught them on Yom Tov. You're right, I don't know how the Gemara analyzes it in that way, but that's what the Gemara says.
In other words, what I was, I agree, I was focusing on the non-Jew also, and I'm thinking, if the non-Jew part of it wasn't important, why did they say that? So in other words, is the fact that it's a Nachri, is that why we can assume that it was,
well, no,
that
so the Nachri,
on Yom Tov? That's
yeah,
what it meant.
The reason why it's interesting that it's a Nachri, or important that it's a Nachri, that it's a non-Jew, is that a Jew presumably was not allowed to go catch a fish on Yom Tov.
Right.
That's trapping.
So we're assuming that it's a Yom Tov catching.
But how are you allowed to accept something on Yom Tov or on Shabbos? I thought you're not allowed to make a kinyan on Yom Tov or Shabbos.
Oh, that's a good. But food, if you're going to eat it, you'd be allowed to. That's good.
There are no refrigerators then. I mean, basically, you're dealing with eating.
Not allowed to accept, but food that you're going to eat on that day. You can accept. So perhaps that's why the Gemara, that's the interpretation of the Gemara then. Meaning the Gemara then says,
wait, wait.
I was just going to
People bring wine to your Shabbos table all the time, don't they?
They do.
And you open it up, don't you? No, you're right. I've been to people who... actually, I had a funny thing.
Say,
I
say, did you make the kinyan on my behalf for Shabbos? Yeah.
Right, but many...
That.
You're right. Many people...
Did
so
do.
What?
Did you make the kinyan on my behalf for Shabbos and Yom Tov? Then you
I'm
can
sure
eat.
You've heard somebody who knows say those words.
No, no. I don't.
Not you.
Yeah.
I'm confused.
But the
okay, I mean,
no, really
about the fish.
I remember when I was first becoming observant, the family invited me for Friday night on the west side actually, and I brought a bottle of wine. I'm sorry.
To bring them fish.
Yeah, I brought a bottle of wine, and they took the bottle of wine, put it aside. Opened up their very large collection of wines and took out the identical bottle of wine and served that one. And they explained to me this. I didn't know this, and they explained this to me. However, many, many people would say...
I think it's become accepted that if you bring a food item...
If you bring a food item for the thing... Now, if you're bringing someone just a gift for Shabbos, like a serving tray or something like that, or flowers, that really should be brought before Shabbos.
Yeah.
Flowers
always is before Shabbos.
Because then you can't do anything with it if it's not Shabbos.
Exactly.
But you could make a kinyan on someone's behalf before. You know, there's a concept called zachin laadam shelo b'funav. I'm allowed to do something. I can do anything that benefits Sandra, for example, because if it objectively benefits her, then there's a presumption that she would appreciate it. So, for example, if I want to, you know, if I buy Sandra a serving tray before I go there for a Shabbos meal, then I can acquire the Shabbos tray on her behalf before the Shabbos meal, assuming that she would want this serving tray,
mm-hmm.
Because it's good for her to have this serving tray, or whatever it is. So you can make these acquisitions on people's behalf. Zachin la'adam shalo b'fanav. That's why, by the way, a Beit Din can convert a katan, a child under the age of 13, when they convert a child... if you convert a child, after all, a child can't accept the conversion upon himself. He's not of age. You have to be 13 or over to be considered an adult in Judaism. And so if you're a young child, or certainly a baby, has no power to accept the conversion. And you know that if you convert, you have to accept the mitzvot and accept everything. So the Gemara in Yevamot and in Gittin says that it's based on Zachin L'Adam Shelo B'Fanav. That it's in Gittin. That the Beis Din is accepting it upon the child's behalf because it's better to be a Jew than to be a non-Jew. So there's a whole ensuing Gemara. Is it really better to be a Jew? Isn't it better to be a non-Jew because you don't have the mitzvos? So it's a whole thing. That's right. It's because of that ensuing conversation about whether or not it's really good to be a Jew, then the child has to accept it at the end.
Schwer
zu sein. That's right. That's right. Yeah. So now, let's understand. So now the fish thing with it, actually, I think now we understand it even better. Because you pointed out that you're not really allowed to make a gift on Yom Tov. And so if this non-Jew is going to give a gift to Rabban Gamliel that he can't eat on that day, then certainly he can't accept it on Yom Tov. And that's why the Gemara can now analyze it and say, it must be that he's not accepting it because he can't eat it. Because if he could eat it, he would have accepted it. But you're not allowed to accept a gift unless it's for the meal, for the shared thing.
I just want to say something. It's really a question, but you know, flowers on the table on Shabbat or Yom Tov, people won't move them. But that's if you assume that they were picked that day.
I think people are worried about you, that the flowers are a growing thing, and you're worried that if you pick up the flowers, you might come to water them, you might come to pick them out. I don't think they're worried about if they're picked that day. I mean, obviously, the flowers.
Wait, if it's in a vase and it's already decorated.
That's right. No, I think.
And then you have to
clean the table.
No, you have to move it off. Of course.
The table, you move it off.
You're allowed to move it. We discussed that last week. We discussed last week that there are certain kinds of mukta that you're allowed to move if you need the place of the space where they are.
Yeah. getting that back to this kish business.
Okay, let's finish the toast vote. So that's the first thing.
Wait a minute. When your mommy says it's permitted to carry but not to eat it.
That's right.
The whole idea is that you would need to eat it that day, so you have to cook it. So
you can cook on Yom Tov.
You can cook on Yom Tov.
Sure.
So why?
Because there is a difference. That's the point. The point is that there's muktza for carrying, and there's muktza for eating. And we're more stringent about eating than we are about carrying. And that remains true. That is a halacha. There are things, I'm not sure exactly where it's applicable. But it's true that we're more stringent with regards to eating than with regards to carrying. It's possible that something is only muktza with regards to eating it and not with regards to carrying it. Like these fish, for example. In the story of Rabban Gamliel. They were not muktza with regards to carrying them, but they were muktza with regards to eating them. Not allowed to eat them. But we discussed that the word muktza means set aside, muktze. And it's the opposite of, just important for those that weren't here last week, it's the opposite of mukhan. Mukhan means ready for Shabbos. By the way, let me tell you, Rabbi Lukstein, his first year that he learned in the Rav's Shir, they learned Masechet Beitza. And when I told Rabbi Lukstein that I was teaching Masechet Beitza here, he gave me his handwritten notes from 1955 with Rav Soloveitchik. And I scanned them in to my computer through the feeding scanner. And as we're learning it, I'm looking at his notes from the
so
Rav's Shir.
Oh, no,
it's very interesting.
Exciting.
Very exciting. And the Rav...
copious notes.
He did.
Because I've seen him.
Yeah, he took copious. Rabbi Lukstein says whenever he heard a lecture from the Rav, he wouldn't even pay attention to the whole lecture. He would just write down everything he can write down, and then he would review it afterwards because he would have to learn it at his own pace. Mm-hmm. And he would, go back to his notes, and that's when he would really pay attention and learn what was going on. Mm-hmm. But he would just take notes the first time around.
Rabbi Lukstein also told us once in Shir that so he thought he knew Beitza great because he learned it with Rabbi Soloveitchik. That's it. He knew it. He reviewed it. And then he went to Shirim 25 years later of people who had been students of the Rav later. He was showing us how the Rav's brain is very plastic, and he'll always revise himself and think.
Sure.
Big. And so he went to Shirim of Talmidim, really, Chachamim, who learned it 25 years later. And he looks at me and goes, I didn't learn that with the Rav, but that the Rav just was always changing and, re-looking at the same thing.
That's right.
So he says, that was really disappointing in a way to me. He goes, I figured I got Beitza down. Beitza, I got it. Mukta, Mutar, I'm good.
So it's an interesting thing. I heard a speech by Rabbi Meir Lichtenstein, who's one of Aaron Lichtenstein's sons. Who's, by the way, whose Yurtzeit was yesterday. Yes. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's first Yurtzeit was yesterday.
My son was there.
Where were you?
Yeah, my son was there.
Listening to Aviva Zornberg.
Oh, in YU.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Rav Meir Lichtenstein, at the Shloshim of Rav Aaron, gave a speech about the differences between Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's style and the Rav's style, Rav Soloveitchik's style. Because he learned with both of them. All of Rav Lichtenstein's sons came to America to learn with the Rav before they learned with Rav Aaron in Israel, with their father in Israel. And the main difference that he says is that Rav Soloveitchik saw, I'll use the example that he gives. The example was, there was something in the rules of tefillah that contradicts something in Birkat Kohanim. I don't remember the details. I don't think he gave the details in the speech, and I don't really know what the details are, but I remember this. There's something in Hilchos Tefillah which contradicts something in Hilchos Birkat Kohanim. And the Rav gave two different shiurim in, decades apart, or years apart, I don't know. But in one shiur, one is published and one is unpublished, but Rav Meir Lichtenstein had a manuscript of the shiur. One shiur was entitled Birkat Kohanim. And the way the shiur begins is he presents this contradiction between Hilchos Tefillah and Birkat Kohanim, and he shows how this contradiction is a stark contradiction, and then he offers a suggestion, a chiddush, about Birkat Kohanim, about how to understand Birkat Kohanim, which then matches it up, it resolves the contradiction with Hilchos Tefillah. Okay? Years later, he gave another shiur. This one was called a shiur about Ilchot Tefillah. Okay? And he begins the shiur the same way. There's a contradiction between Ilchot Tefillah and Birkat Kohanim. Look, contradiction. What does he do in this one? He gives a chiddush, a new interpretation of Ilchot Tefillah in a way that matches it up, in a way that resolves the contradiction with Birkat Kohanim. And Rav Meir Lichtenstein took this to his father, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and said, "Father, can I make a suggestion? I think that if you would have given the shiur, you would not have had two different shiurim. It would have been one shiur, and both suggestions would have been in the same shiur." And that's right. For those who've been to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's shiurim, it's very different from the Rav. The Rav began with a contradiction, and then, you know, in a shiur about Birkat Kohanim, then the goal is to have a chiddush, a thesis about Birkat Kohanim. If the shiur is about Ilchot Tefillah, then there's a thesis about Ilchot Tefillah. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein wanted to have this sort of broad view of everything. And so in his shiurim, he would say, listen, there's a contradiction between Ilchot Tefillah and Birkat Kohanim. And there are two ways of looking at this tension between Ilchot Tefillah and Birkat Kohanim. One way, one aspect of it is that Birkat Kohanim maybe has this with Ilchot Tefillah, and Ilchot Tefillah has this with the Birkat Kohanim. And indeed, people who learned with Rav Soloveitchik, he could teach Masechet Beitza 1 year, 8 years later, teach Masechet Beitza again, and the notes would be completely different with the new interpretations. Not so with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, if he learned something, if he taught Masechet Beitza in 1982, and then again in 2002, it would be exactly the same thing. Even if he didn't have his own notes. But it would be exactly the same thing, because in his view, he sort of surveys all of the literature and puts together all the possibilities. Because in his view, the way to learn was to look at all the different possibilities of interpretation. So I think it's an interesting distinction.
Very, very.
Yeah.
Okay, so the fish. Are we all
okay
that?
Let's move on from the fish. So now Tosfos is a distinction. Why did the Mishnah say Te'achel velo Te'achel instead of Osrinu Matirin or Matirinu veOsrin? Because if it said Matirin veOsrin, you would have thought that it's to carry, to hold on to them. This way you know that it's even Usr, Beit Hillel even prohibits it. That Beit Shammai even permits it to eat. You would have thought that Beit Shammai prohibits it to carry but not to eat. This way you know that Beit Shammai... Oh, God, I keep on messing it up. Permits. Permits it to carry and to eat. Okay? Permits it both for carrying and eating. Okay. Okay, let's stop there. The rest of the Tosfos just says... let's finish it. V'im tomar. So now we are... you see the first word on the line is Be'achila. Mm-hmm. It's right in the middle of the narrow lines of the Tosfot. Mm-hmm. Close to the end of the box where it says Beitza, the big box in the middle of Beitza, close to the end of that box, Be'achila. Okay, in the middle of the line, Ve'im Tomar. Mm-hmm. So now we feel like we've resolved the question, but there's still another question. Ve'im Tomar le'Beit Hillel de'amrei lo te'achel aval etaltel share. If the reason why it says, Te'achel velo Te'achel, is because you would have thought Beit Shammai permits carrying and not eating. Then now that it says Te'achel, you can ask the question the other way, about Beit Hillel. I mean, I think we should understand.
I think it's a little confusing.
So,
what's Kuf Yam and
Kaimalan?
Kaimalan, right.
We're not there yet, though. So, we saw that Beit Hillel prohibits letaltel and le'echol. You know what? 1 second. Better. Letaltel and le'echol. A little chart. And we have Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. The truth is that Beit Hillel prohibits both, and Beit Shammai permits both. That's what we want to know. Had it said Osrin and Matirin instead of Te'achel v'lo Te'achel, then I would have thought that Beit Shammai permits lataltel, but prohibits to eat, because asur and mutar, it sounds like it means carrying, but it doesn't necessarily mean to eat. So it has to say le'echol, so we know that even this, afilu le'echol, and kal v'chomer lataltel, because if eating is permitted, certainly you can't carry without, you can't eat without carrying, so certainly carrying is permitted. But now that it says le'echol, the Tosfos say, then I messed this one up. Because it says le'echol is prohibited, so I might think
that might be
that this is permitted. Fine, eating is prohibited, but maybe carrying, which is less severe, is permitted.
But we don't know one way or the other from the language of the.
No, we don't, but we know that they prohibit both.
We know that they
the Gemara, the assumption the whole way is that they prohibit both. So what do they say? But we know that this can't be. We know that they have to prohibit both. So why now? So what does the Re has an answer for that. The Hakaimalan de Afla Teltel Asur. We know that Beit Hillel holds that it's prohibited to even carry it from the Dalet Amud Aleph. Lachen Pirei Shri, therefore, the Re, Rabbeinu Yitzchak, explains, the Nakat Ki Hai Lishna, the Stam Beit Selechi Lakaima. It says Tachel and Lo Tachel, because normally eggs are eaten, and so that's why. It's so anticlimactic, because up until now, you know, there's all these halachic distinctions, forget it, no halachic distinction. Normally, eggs are eaten. That's why. Odiye Shlomar, second answer, Dinakat LeBeit Shammai Teachel, Mishum Demashma Achila V'Tiltol. Since Beit Shammai had to say Teachel, so that you know that they permit both eating and carrying. Dein Achila below Tiltol, because you can't eat without carrying. Veitil Asriyaf B'Tiltol, Ela Agav Dinakte Beit Shammai Teachel, Nakte Inehu Lo Teachel. Because Beit Shammai used the word eating, Beit Hillel also used the word eating to make a parallel reference in the Mishnah. Okay. So that was Tosfot.
And we know from another source that Beit Hillel says?
No, from Daf Dalet Amud Aleph.
Oh, okay.
It says later on that we know that Beit Hillel also means
You can't carry.
You can't, right. Okay. Okay. Let's move on to the Gemara. But, you know, it was good to see this Tosfot, because a lot of times the Tosfot that we see are contradictions with other Gemaras. Tosfot will present a contradiction and then they want to resolve the contradiction. Here, it's not a contradiction of the Gemara. They had a question about the language in the Mishnah. Why was a specific word chosen rather than a broader word that could have been chosen? And really, three suggestions were made, three possibilities. One was rejected right off the bat, and that is that maybe it's maybe Ostrin and Matirin would have meant even after Yom Tov. That's rejected because we know that the Gemara elsewhere uses the words Ostrin and Matirin, and it only means on Yom Tov. So that's not the answer. Then they suggested that it's because of there's a distinction between Muktza with regards to eating and Muktza with regards to carrying. And that's the suggestion that's adopted. Yet there's still a problem, and they resolve that through another means. Okay, let's move on to the Gemara. What kind of egg are we dealing with? You see, the Mishnah said that if an egg is laid on Yom Tov, then it's muktzah, according to Beit Hillel. But the Gemara is going to point out that that depends on what kind of chicken laid the egg. You see, if food comes out of food, then it's not muktzah, it's not nolad. Because if food produced food, then there's nothing new. You had food, and now you have more food. So what kind of chicken would be permitted?
The kind that you would cook.
That's right. The Gemara is going to tell us that if it's a chicken that was meant to be shechted and then eaten, if that kind of chicken lays an egg, then the egg should be permitted. If the chicken is the kind of chicken that sits and lays eggs, you work for Eggland Farms or whatever it is, and that's the chickens that you have, they sit in their coop and lay eggs, then that kind of egg would certainly be muktzah, because that chicken was not meant to be eaten. It was never food. That chicken was never food.
So from a layer, from the chickens in the coop that are laid, I actually worked in a kibbutz for a few months where
I was in charge of that. So there's actually a difference, quite a big difference.
Right.
So I mean, from the layer, you're not allowed to harvest the egg or eat the egg on Yom Tov.
That's right. Okay, let's read the Gemara and we'll
Does
see what it says.
Mean it's a chicken that I don't know anything about chickens. Does it mean that it's a chicken that you specifically set aside and said I'm going to shechit?
That's right.
It's not that it's the type of chicken. That
No. Or it could be. No, it
there are separate chickens. There are separate layers.
I think it's more like the chickens that roam around. The chickens that, you know, if you're a farmer,
you have your
food chickens,
right,
that you're fluffing up. You're feeding them, you know, beer and massaging them and everything. I guess that's the beef, right? The Kobe beef. Okay, so you're doing whatever you do to chickens that you want.
But it's not that you specifically have that chicken.
No. You don't have to have that chicken in mind. No. But I also think that in those days they didn't have farmers with thousands of chickens. You were a guy. You had a 10x20 little lot, and you had a couple of chickens that lay eggs, and you had a couple of chickens that you're growing to shech.
But what about milk from a cow?
Good question. We're gonna continue. That's a good question. It would be the same thing. Milk from a cow is muktzah.
Right.
That's why in Israel,
that
it's not muktzah. It's the same idea. It would be the same exact idea.
Milk from a milk cow.
What?
Milk from a milk cow.
So that's right. In Israel, for example, that's a big problem for the farmers to milk on Shabbos. So that's actually one of the distinctions between the Mahadrin and the regular Rabbanut. The regular Rabbanut allows machine. So, you know, nowadays you don't milk cows. It's all machine milking cows. They don't have people milking cows. So the regular Rabbanut holds by an opinion that if a machine milks the cow on Shabbos, it's okay. And they sell that milk. The Mahadrin Rabbanut doesn't hold of that. And so if you get Mahadrin milk, it's never milk that was milked on Shabbos. So I know people, for example, this is one of the,
a set-aside shecheted chicken, so we can eat her
eggs. That's right.
But we can't
let's read the Gemara. Let's read it inside.
Wouldn't that be the same with the milk from a milk from a milk cow? Not allowed. It has to be a milk from a shecheted cow.
Right, presumably. Let's read. B'mai askinan.
Yes, exactly.
What?
I said we're lucky we're allowed to breastfeed on Shabbos.
Well, that's what I was saying.
Well, but breastfeeding you're allowed to, but you're not allowed to. But pumping on Shabbos is an interesting topic. So there's ways. I mean, they allow it. They allow pumping on Shabbos for various reasons. But there are people that won't use the pump. There are people that pump on Shabbos because you have to. But there are people that won't use that pumped milk on Shabbos. You won't use that pumped milk on Shabbos. You'll pump
something?
It into something with soap, just like they would.
Can I just say something? I mean, these are problems to a large extent also of a wealthy society, because if you're dealing with the only food that baby's ever going to get, if you're in the middle of nowhere or Alaska or in the Amazon or something, and the only way that kid's going to get nourishment is breast milk, you are not.
No, but you're not pumping. But that's not pumping.
Right.
Breastfeeding, you're allowed. This is pumping. It's a different thing. Breastfeeding is not the same thing as pumping. Breastfeeding is providing for the needs of the infant right now. That's allowed. You're allowed to provide for the needs of the infant right now.
Right. But there are people who have multiple children. So you have twins or you have triplets or stuff like that. And I've seen this with my sister and best friends who have. And they extract milk for one while they're feeding the other.
Uh-huh.
And the answer is, since the mother has to continue to produce the milk at certain rates and her body is regulated based on what's taken out, what's put in, you know, the point is
to throw that
milk out, and then the baby, then she has to produce.
That's right. So again, if any of these things would cause harm to the baby, cause problems for the baby, then there are leniencies.
You just do it.
If there are any of these things would cause a problem for the infant, then there are lenient.
Yeah,
then there are ways.
It's for the mother in this case. It's not that. I mean, basically, you know.
Right. If the mother is pumping, because
children or three children, obviously you have to figure it out what you can do with your.
Right. I also think though there's something I've thought about this a lot, maybe some other time, but just to keep in mind. I mean, a lot of these problems are problems with affluent societies. That we will get so medactic over this, and can we do this, or move this bottle, or do that? And the answer is, in a regular world of people who keep mitzvot, okay, sometimes you don't have those luxuries to even think about.
Well, there are dispensations for all of those things,
uh-huh.
meaning anything like that we discussed, moving this and moving that. If you need the object, you know, if you need your
If you need the jar that the flowers are in, I'm just saying.
So right. Can you, Okay, let's read the Gemara. B'maya skinan. What are we dealing with? Where it says Gimel Mem for Gemara. B'maya skinan. What are we dealing with? E lema betarnegolas omedes leachila. If you say that it's a chicken that is meant to be eaten, haomedet leachila, right? My ta'amayu debate Hillel. Then what's Beit Hillel's reasoning that they prohibit it? Uchla de afra tu. It's food that came out of food. I don't really know what Uchla de afra means, but Rashi and Tosfot both comment, which look, they both, nobody knows what it means, because they both comment that it means food that came out of food. I don't know what the word afrat means, Ella, betarnegola ta'omedet legadel beitzim. Rather, it must be that this Mishnah is about a chicken which is meant to grow eggs, to lay eggs. So therefore, my ta'amayu de Beit Shammai. Muktzahi. Then how can Beit Shammai permit it? If it's about a hen that's meant to lay eggs, then how can Beit Shammai permit it? It's obviously muktzah. Umay kushya. What's the problem? Dilma Beit Shammai leit lahu muktzah. Maybe Beit Shammai holds like, you guys remember last week we discussed Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda. Throughout the Mishnah and the Gemara, there are two opinions, Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Shimon has a very, very narrow view of muktzah. No lot is not one of his muktzahs. Sorry, no lot is. We're going to see in a moment that no lot is one of his muktzahs. But Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda have two different views of muktzah. So maybe Beit Shammai doesn't hold of muktzah, like Rabbi Shimon. Kasalka
da...
No, doesn't hold of muktzah means that he holds like Rabbi Shimon with regards to muktzah.
Okay.
Everybody agrees that there's something called muktzah.
Okay.
Actually, I saw in Rabbi Luchstein's notes of Rav Soloveitchik a good way of explaining the distinction between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda. Is that they define muktzah differently. And this is a great brisker chakira. Right, we saw that there's a list of things that Rabbi Yehuda considers muktzah, and Rabbi Shimon only considers a fraction of those things muktzah, and everything else is not muktzah. And Rav Soloveitchik said something which really, anybody who thinks like this, when I saw it, I said, how come I didn't think of that, That's the greatness. He said that Rabbi Yehuda He said that the distinction is one of Heftza and Gavra. Is Muktza about the object, or is Muktza about the individual? So for Rabbi Yehuda, Muktza is about the object. Once an object is Muktza, it's Muktza for the rest of Shabbos. It doesn't change its status. If an object has not been prepared, if it was not in your thought that an object could be used on Shabbos, then it's Muktza. Right, we discussed that there are certain opinions, that there are certain times when something that was muktzah can become not muktzah. That's Rabbi Shimon's opinion. Rabbi Shimon believes that muktzah is in the gavra, meaning it's about how you regard your objects. If you regard an object as not being useful on Shabbos, then it's muktzah. But if now, over the course of a Shabbos, you realize that you need an object in a way that's permitted on Shabbat besides for muktzah, then now that object is not muktzah anymore.
I could see that they'd go nuts with that as a slippery slope. Whoa.
So you'll see why this is next week in the Gemara. We'll see that slippery slope issue.
Who we follow?
Rabbi Yehuda, yeah. All the muktzah that you know about is Rabbi Yehuda muktzah.
Of course.
But look, Beit Hillel here follows a stringent opinion.
Are Sfardim different?
No, not with regards to muktzah.
Can't change over.
You know, there are a lot of things where there are a lot of things where Sfardim are more stringent about than Ashkenazim. And kashrus, for example, not kashrus in the home, but meat kashrus is more complicated for Sephardic Jews.
Why? How?
Because meat for Sephardim has to be very, very glatt meat. A lot of the meat that we Ashkenazim eat is not glatt enough for Sephardim. Because all the leniencies with regards to the smooth, a cow's lungs to be kosher have to be smooth. And the Rama writes leniencies about that. Because in Eastern Europe there was a shortage of cows, I don't know. But there are leniencies for Ashkenazim. In Israel, again, the Rabbanut serves completely non-glatt meat. In America, you can't really get kosher non-glatt meat. It's very hard to find. That's the Sephardic. Shitat Ben Yosef.
But is it more glatt than, let's say, Badatz, Ashkenazi?
Yeah. There's Sephardim in Israel. Real Sephardim will only buy something that says Shchitat Bet Yosef. Bet Yosef is the Shulchan Aruch. He's Rabbi Yosef Karo. So his opinion about glatt, about what glatt means, smooth. That's what it means. So there are Sephardim that only buy that. The other one where they're more stringent is with regards to Bishul Akum. For Sephardim, just turning on the stove or just turning on the oven is not enough. They have to have real involvement in the cooking. And so most kosher restaurants in New York, if you're a real Sephardic Jew and you follow that, for many kosher restaurants, it's not enough. You can't, many Sephardim can't really eat at those restaurants or don't eat at those restaurants.
Because the
Bishul Akum in those restaurants, the chef, the cooks are not Jewish, and the Jewish Mashgiach only turned on the stove. A lot of Hashgachas are now more aware of that, because there are a lot of, I think Hashgachas used to completely ignore the fact that there was Sephardim in New York. But a lot of the Hashgachas are now more aware of that. Okay, let's just finish this one thought so that we get to the end of it. Okay. Kasalka da'atin afilu man d'shari b'muktza b'nolad aser. No, but we know, he says, kasalka da'atin, we might think that one who permits muktza, like Rabbi Shimon, still prohibits nolad, because nolad is such a great category of muktza. It's one of the worst categories of muktza. My tamau de Beit Shammai. So therefore, what is Beit Shammai's reason to permit it? That's what we're going to leave off. The Gemara over the next three pages will offer four suggestions as to why Beit Shammai can permit muktzah, and we'll look at them next week. And next week we'll also first read the Tosfot as to why maybe a newspaper is okay on Shabbos.